You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm Alan Cardoza, and arriving anytime now will be my co-host extraordinaire, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox. She had a little personal business, a family business to take care of this morning, but she will be here shortly. And I want to remind everybody that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain you while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and dealing with addictions, as well as much more. With many years of experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with talented authors and top professionals who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. We will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Our topic today is leaving behind the baggage of a troubled childhood. Our guest book explores the story of how adults who were raised in troubled families found the courage and strength to transcend the past by leaving behind archaic thoughts and behavior in their search for a grounded adulthood. Our guest today is James P. Krehbiel, who is an educator, writer, licensed professional counselor, and nationally certified cognitive behavioral therapist practicing in Scottsdale, Arizona. He specializes in treating adults and children experiencing anxiety and depression. He served as a teacher and guidance counselor for 30 years and has taught graduate-level counselor education courses for Chapman University. His latest book, Troubled Childhood, Triumphant Life, Healing from the Battle Scars of Youth, is about the impact of troubled childhoods on adult functioning. James, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Alan, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, I'm glad to have you. And in fact, and as you'll see, when I announced our time as far as Mondays 11 to noon, and I said Pacific time, because we've been having all kinds of stuff out there with people saying, well, but is it daylight savings time now, or is it Pacific Standard time? So it's just Pacific time. And for everybody out there, we're glad that you're out there listening to us. Now, what I'd like to touch on, James, is I guess to start with is, I mean, what prompted you to write Troubled Childhood, Triumphant Life?
Well, over the years, I counseled many people who felt stuck as adults, and they kept telling me, you know, that they were recreating some of the same worn-out patterns of thinking and behavior that haunted them during childhood. And I began to ask some questions. One of the questions I ask is, why do some adults tend to navigate a troubled childhood successfully, whereas others remain powerless over their past? And I knew from my own personal experience, that there were some issues in my own childhood that were problems. And as I saw these adults and I talked to them, I began to understand that they felt responsible for some of the things that happened to them that they had no control over.
Now, I mean, in your book, you refer to leaving behind the magical illusion of childhood. What is the magical illusion of childhood that many people seem to carry into adulthood?
Well, thanks for asking. It's an important idea that people tend to cling to this notion that their parents are going to morph and become these loving, nurturing adults that they always yearn for during childhood. And I'm talking now about adults that experienced adverse childhood experiences during childhood. Troubled kids, they tend to perform to please, and they'll do X and they'll do Y and they'll do Z in order to try to gain the love and validation of their parents. And when it's not forthcoming, they'll turn their anger on themselves. And they come to a conclusion, and the conclusion is, the assumption is, that they must be defective. Now, the reason why they do this is that way they can begin to let their parents off the hook, they can minimize the pain of the past and the pain of the present, And that keeps them in a position of denial and not really dealing effectively with what's going on.
Wow. Now, what are some of the negative interpretations that adults make during childhood that later affects their adult functioning?
What happens is there are certain rules, unwritten rules, that govern individuals from a dysfunctional family. And what I try to do as a therapist is to ferret these out. I try to find out what they are. For example, individuals will be thinking, I must avoid conflict at all costs. It's better to be brave. And brave means not showing emotions. I must appear to be strong at all times. It's better to appear good, or my family to appear good, than for us to actually feel good. Or every time I try to get close to people, someone stabs me in the back. These assumptions, these core assumptions, then play a role in how people activate certain behaviors, thoughts, and feelings during their adulthood.
Wow. Now, I mean, would that be one of the reasons why there seems to be so many people out there having to deal with things like depression?
Yes. And what happens is that people believe that they may have an assumption that enough is enough is never enough. Or they might have an assumption that no matter what I do, it's never good enough. Or they may have an assumption that if I don't watch myself, I'm going to get hurt. Or I must perform admirably at all times. And when people do that, they feel disappointed, they feel sad, they feel hopeless, they feel like there's no avenue open to them, they feel trapped. And so there is a relationship between these kinds of assumptions that people have and how they activate their emotions and beliefs and thoughts in adulthood. But one of the key components of depression is, I just feel like things are hopeless. I don't want to get up in the morning. I feel like there's nothing to get up for.
Right. And you mentioned in regards to, and as far as the hopelessness, but you also said disappointment. Are we talking about the fact that they're disappointed in themselves because they can't find perfection, or are they just concerned that other people are disappointed in them?
It's actually both. That it generally starts out with childhood, that someone disappoints them, that somehow they keep getting slammed, that someone in their life, a parent, someone, doesn't give them what they need and what they want. Promises are made and promises are unkept. And if this continues to go on chronically over a period of time, people begin to believe that nothing good is going to happen. And then at some point they internalize that. And then they believe that somehow they're just defective and they can't make things work. So they go into adulthood believing, no matter how hard I try, I can't make anything come out right.
Now, would that come from, say, a parent who really never showed appreciation or gratitude for what the child was doing as they were forming into their, the person they were going to become?
It's generally from parents who are emotionally unavailable. They're just not there. They're absent in action. That they're just so preoccupied with their own lives, with their own addictions, with their own difficulties, with their own problems, that they do not have the time to invest emotionally in being there for their child. And because of that, the child must fend for himself, try to make sense out of his world, and move on. And with that in mind, then there's a lack of connection being made. There's no connectedness being made with the child. And at that point, the child begins to believe that, no, it's not my parents that are unlovable. I must be the one that's unlovable because it's not being delivered to me.
Now, and is that child then the one that often becomes the pleaser, that is constantly trying to please other people in hopes to get that they so desire?
Yes, it goes one of two ways. It's usually very either or. Either the child becomes highly compliant, like you say, and begins pleasing the parent. And then as they go into adulthood, they begin trying to please everybody else in order to get the validation that they never had. Or during adolescence, a child may act out in response to not getting their needs met, and may end up either, you know, self-medicating or end up in the criminal justice system, or run away or whatever, because they're not getting their needs met. So they may act out in response to unmet needs.
Right. So you're saying that they may go to one extreme or the other. Either they're going to become this huge pleaser that's constantly trying to gain validation by pleasing people, or they could go the other way. And I mean, do they almost to the point of dehumanize other people because it's not anything that you expect or want from them?
Yeah, they begin to view authority figures as their enemies. They begin to act out and come up against people who are in a position of authority because that's their only way of responding with their anger. Because if you look at dysfunctional families, what happens is kids don't have an opportunity to express their feelings. There's no disclosure. There's a lack of the ability of people to share their anger. So anger is generally thwarted. So it's either turned inward or it's turned outward on other authority figures.
Or possibly loved ones.
That's correct.
Yeah, sorry to hear that.
yeah.
You know, we've got some questions that have come in, questions and comments that have come in from listeners, and I'd like to read one that I think touches on the depression issue. And again,
sure.
I want to thank everybody out there that sends these messages in. It tells us that you're getting our press releases and that you're interested in the guests that we're having. So again, we definitely appreciate it. Now, this particular question says, I was diagnosed with severe depression 3 years ago. During my treatment, I came to understand and acknowledge the many unresolved childhood thought patterns that were at the heart of my condition. After detaching myself from the responsibility of my parents' problems and simultaneously working the, quote, negative thought patterns, my depression disappeared. I very much enjoyed reading your material and encourage anyone listening who is dealing with depression to follow suit.
That's a wonderful statement, and it pretty well crystallizes and sums up my message and my mission and what I'm trying to accomplish. And I think one of the key elements of that response has to do with detachment, appropriate detachment, of setting boundaries. And you can see in this case that the individual had learned how to detach her feelings or his feelings from others, from the others in his sphere of influence, and say, hey, I'm not connected in the sense that I need to be concerned about the burden of other people's feelings. I'll set my boundaries, I'll set my perspective, and go with it. And so it's a very, very poignant statement.
Well, yeah, and I think that the other thing this points to is that, you know, they figured it out and they went and got treatment, and it worked. I mean, so,
yes.
You know, that's the beauty of it. Now, one of the questions I have is that now why do some adults from troubled childhoods live completely productive lives, whereas others seem to either replicate the past or rebel against it?
Well, what happens is, what I've seen is that those who replicate the past never process it. What they do is they tend to dwell on it. They ruminate about it, poor me, or they avoid the past by burying it, and they bury it through intellectualizing, obsessing, or self-medicating, or any other techniques that they might use to minimize the pain. And what I found is those who triumph over their troubled childhood are able to process the past, and they do this by experiencing the full emotional impact of what happened, and then they learn to release it. They literally swallow the bitter pill, understanding that there's no one, including their parents, who can rescue them. It's this recognition, it's the grieving and the releasing that frees people up to create new ways of thinking, behaving in the present. And that's what your person who wrote the statement, the summary, that wonderful summary, had done. She processed her past in a position to move on from it.
Exactly, yeah, and it says that, you know, that they detach themselves from the responsibility of the parents' problems, and I thought that was a huge point in itself. Wouldn't you agree?
That's a huge point, because the most critical aspect that I saw with patients and have seen is that they come to see me believing that somehow their past is their problem. They view it as being, I'm at fault. I created this. It's my thing. And what I have to continuously repeat to people is it never was about you. You didn't do anything, you didn't cause it, you didn't create it, and you couldn't control it. It was all about your parents' inability to be there for you. They probably tried as hard as they could, they did the best they could, they didn't have the tools, but it just wasn't enough. And so I try to tell them that it's not their fault. It's never their fault, in that they need to understand that even though it's not their fault, that it is their responsibility, like the situation that you just read, to overcome the obstacles of the past and learn to live in the here and now.
Now, do you find that this is more prevalent in families where there was a divorce while the kids were still young?
Not necessarily. I don't find it necessarily that divorce is necessarily associated. My feelings about divorce are, you know, generally where it really becomes a problem for children is when the parents are unable to put aside their differences after the divorce and are unable to meet the needs of their children. So divorce really isn't as much of a factor as people would believe, because I've seen people that have been in, quote, intact families where there's so much feuding and fussing and abuse that's going on that it's really a moot point. The key, the critical issue is, are kids' needs being met, whether they're in a single-parent family or whether they're in a, you know, a with two-parent family.
Now, speaking of needs being met, and again, and I talk with a lot of parents, and I speak before some parent groups, and it's interesting to me when we talk about the difference between effective parenting or ineffective parenting, and it's interesting to me that there are some people that will have a difference of opinion on that, on what they think is right or what they think is working. Give us some examples of ineffective parenting and some of those in which people might go, wow, I kind of thought that was effective.
Well, one of the things that I noticed with ineffective parenting is that people tend to accentuate negative consequences to the exclusion of positive. That they generally will tend to get caught up in a lot of power struggles over little issues. For example, they'll get caught up in, you know, something regarding the hair color of their daughter, or they'll get caught up in what kind of clothes that their children are wearing. I'm not saying there shouldn't be. There obviously need to be rules for that. But my point is that when we get caught up in the little issues, we miss the major issues. And we should be teaching our kids about kindness and civility and also setting consequences, not only negative consequences, but positive consequences. So I've learned over time that reinforcement of positive consequences is much more effective than accentuating the negative and using a lot of negative consequences, although at times with people it needs to be done. Parents generally they either overfunction, they underfunction, they get caught up in their own problems, they may self-medicate, they may use divorce as a way that causes split loyalties. They may use harsh and critical discipline as a means of dealing with their children. And I find that these are the kinds of things that need to be avoided.
Well, let me share one with you and see if you agree. And that would be the difference of of grounding in regards to grades. And one of the things that I've actually spoken about or written about is that if you have a situation to where you're saying, you know, if you don't get your grades up from a D to a B, you know, you're going to have to go to summer school and or be grounded over a period of time. And one of the suggestions that I had in regards to that, or a parent that had brought that up, was, and I said, well, what if you reword that to the point of saying, you know what, if you don't get your grades up from a B to a D, you're going to have to make that up and you're going to have to go to summer school. But if you get it up from a D to a B, you will have shown that you, you know, that you care about it. And I think it will be something to where you, you know, you've shown that you can be responsible, to where maybe this summer we will change your curfew from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock. Is that something that we can both agree on? So would that be an example of what you're saying?
That would be an example of what I'm saying, that many times things get framed in such a negative way. A teacher may say at the beginning of the year to a group of children, they may say something like, well, what's going to happen is if you don't study hard and work hard in my class, many of you are not going to make it here. You're going to end up getting poor grades, so you're going to have to apply yourself, because if you don't, this is what's going to happen. As opposed to framing it and saying, look, I'm glad you're in my class, and I want you to know I'm going to clearly articulate what the expectations are for this class to get an A or to get a B. If you work hard in my class and you do these things, you'll have an opportunity to get positive grades in my class. If you don't, that'll be unfortunate. So a lot of it has to do with how we frame things with people. But it also has to do with the fact that you noted that positive reinforcement, that the use of reinforcement is a very, very important thing.
Yeah, then that's what I was thinking is that, you know, if you have it to where it's only negative, it's you do this or there's a negative consequence, and go, well, let's talk about doing this and here's the positive that can come out of it, or there is a negative in your mind because we believe that if you don't get that taken care of, you're not going to graduate, so you will need to make it up during the summer. That becomes your choice. So yeah, I certainly agree. Now let's look at the other side, and it's the side that I like the most. What are some examples of really good positive parenting? And for those of you out there, if you're going to take notes or something, if you're driving, not going to happen, but know that you can go to the website, and if you want to be able to rehear this, you can go to answers4thefamilyblog.com. You can still hear some of these answers again, so don't do anything crazy out there. I had somebody that said, oh, you know, I learned something that was so good that I ended up pulling over to write it down. And I went, okay, but you can't always go back and listen to it as well. Which actually reminds me, then also, you know, if you need or if you want to get a hold of James, or you want to learn about the book or whatever, you can go to his website as well, which is www.scottsdaletherapy.net. Now, James, is that also the best place to get the book?
The best place to get the book would be through Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble's.
That's great.
Or any other online bookstore.
Sounds good. So, what are some of these examples you can give us of positive parenting?
Well, I can't emphasize enough that the key to good parenting is involvement. The level of involvement that you have with your child determines everything else. If you have a positive connection, if you are involved in terms to the degree that you can in terms of your child's activities, if you're aware of what he's doing, if you're aware of and are talking to your child about critical life issues, if you are teaching and coaching your child discipline rather than just talking about it, if you are asking your child questions as opposed to pontificating and dictating, that's very important. The other issue is just nurturing, of being, you know, affectionate, of being very positive in terms of that is important. Affirming your kids. And that doesn't mean praising them all the time, but it does mean encouraging them, coaching them, teaching them that they can accomplish things, and giving them a sense that they can accomplish a lot, and helping them to set goals. And what's important also in parenting is, again, is to let the children make value judgments about how they're doing, as opposed to making them for them yourself. What I mean by that is that kids are more likely to act on something if they've made the judgment. For example, in their schoolwork, if you ask a kid, are you happy with how you're doing in school? If they're not, invariably they'll tell you honestly that they don't think they're doing as well as they can. And then you follow up and you say, well, what would it take for you to move that grade up? And you begin exploring that with them. That's what I call non-evaluative exploration. So you're actually boxing the child in and helping them to make a decision about what's important. And setting clear boundaries is important so that they know what your expectations are. These are the things that are really, really important. These are deal breakers. You know, if you do something like this, I'm really going to be on your case. And so they understand clearly what the boundaries are upon which they should be behaving.
Well, and that sounds great. Now, what about the student that is not doing well, and then you ask them those things and say, what are the things that you think you can be doing to get these grades up from D's and F's to the level in which we know that you're capable of? And they go, nothing. There's nothing we can do.
Well, there may be situations where realistically there may be a child, and realistically a child cannot accomplish certain things. And in that case, you need to look at some other options. It may be that they can't and that they're in the wrong placement, that educationally they're not in a school setting that's workable for them. Or I found kids that aren't able to accomplish things because they don't have the motivation. They don't have the motivation because they're depressed. Generally, kids will respond to encouragement, reinforcement. And if they don't, what I generally find is behind that, there's some kind of disorder. There's some kind of anxiety. There's some kind of family problem. There's some kind of depression that's keeping the kid from being able to move forward and to actually progress.
All right. Now, in your book, you refer to it as a triumphant life. What is your definition of a triumphant life, and what does it look like to you?
Well, I think there are certain qualities that I would look for and say that are associated with that. For example, feeling empowered, developing new and more meaningful relationships, learning how to assert oneself, learning how to express feelings appropriately, learning how to forgive others, parenting more effectively, establishing more effective behaviors, handling conflict in a more meaningful way, just trusting life, feeling comfortable with aloneness, and learning to live in the present moment, I think, are important examples of people who have moved forward in the process of finding a triumphant life.
Well, speaking of a triumphant life, my co-host extraordinaire, Dr. Melody Fox, has just walked in. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Well, thank you. My apologies for being late, but I had to take care of some family matters this morning, and I'm just glad I was able to rush up here because I so wanted the opportunity to talk with James, our guest today. I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist, and I do believe in the techniques, and they work when you work it. They're empirically validated, and I'm just thrilled he's here.
Well, and your timing is actually perfect. And again, the show's called Answers for the Family. So if you're not out, if you're going to give up on doing things that you should be doing with your family, then we're not sending the right message. So I think it's absolutely right that you are taking care of family.
Yes.
And that's why we work as a team. And mm-hmm. The beauty of it now is that we're going to go to commercial. And when we come back, Melody is going to be taking over, and I'm going to be rushing off to catch an airplane to work with another family in another state.
Okay, so that's, you get the best of both worlds here today, James.
So
yeah, this is great. Alan, you have a good trip.
thank you very
and
much.
And Melanie, hello.
Hello.
All right, now we're going to take a break, and we will be right back, and we are talking with James Crable and his book, which is entitled Triumphant Life. Talk to you soon. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we're back with the switch off here. I'm Dr. Melody Fox, clinical psychologist and marriage family therapist in a private practice in Newport Beach, California. And running a little bit late today due to taking care of my own family issues. And one of the things as a therapist I think it's important to do is that you need to take care of yourself and take care of your family, or you're not doing what you need to do to show your clients on what's important, how to prioritize things. Alan Cardoza, our co-host, just stepped out. He has a plane to catch to go help another family doing his job as a private investigator and helping lost children or abducted children, and he's doing that. And our guest today is Dr. Crable, and I'm so thrilled that he's here with us today. And are you still there, I hope?
Yes, it's James.
James. Okay, we'll go by James today. Thank you so much. And again, I'm thrilled that you're here today and talking about, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and how it works and how families could use it, and in regards to the book that you've written, which I think is extraordinary. And I'm sure that it's been mentioned before. Alan's mentioned it or had you mention it. But if people want to get a copy of your book, where can they go, and are there any websites that they could go to?
Well, they can go to my website, Dr. Melody, at scottsdaletherapy.net, or they can go to amazon.com, or they can go to Barnes & Noble's or any other bookstores, and many of them are carrying it, or if not, they can pick it up online.
Mm-hmm. And it is a great book, and I do highly recommend it. I'm not trying to be biased here, but I might be a little bit. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to listen to what you and Alan had talked about on my way in. However, I do know that you've probably already touched on examples of positive parenting and examples of ineffective parenting. But what are some characteristics that adults can demonstrate that show the long-term effects of inadequate parenting?
Well, I think the important thing is that when parents do one of two things, they're either emotionally unavailable or they go to the other extreme to overfunction. This creates a tremendous problem with kids. If they're not available to kids, if they're absent in action, it's going to be a critical problem with children. On the other hand, if they're constantly living through their kids in a vicarious way, and they're constantly doing for their children rather than letting them do for themselves, their children never learn self-reliance. They never learn how to grow up and be self-determining adults. And so I think those are critical aspects. I also find that when parents are just so caught up in their own problems, they're just, constantly immersed in their own life issues, Of course, self-medicating is another issue that's a parental problem. When parents use divorce in a way that actually splits loyalties with children, harsh and critical discipline, we talked about that a little earlier, is another example of poor parenting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about overfunctioning and parents living vicariously through their children. Now, I happen to see a lot of that. And I don't know if it has to do with being in the Los Angeles area. You know, people, their children, they want their children to be singers and dancers and actors and actresses and are really pushing them to go in that direction, or, you know, famous photographers. And the child really doesn't want to do that, but that's the parent's dream.
That's exactly right. I had a couple come in to see me a while back, and they said to me, our son, can you deal with athletic stress? And I said, sure, I can deal with athletic stress. Well, my son is up to be the varsity quarterback, and I need to, you know, I want to see if you can manage his stress, because that's what's holding him back from being able to quarterback this football team. And then I met with the child and found out that he could care less about playing football at all. In fact, his life ambition, or one of them, was to play hockey. And he loved playing hockey. He was actually doing it and doing it quite well. Mm-hmm. And so then after I got done with him, I could tell he was very discouraged about what his parents were saying. And I brought them back in, and they were irate. They were angry at me, because I didn't give them what they wanted. But their child in no way had any desire to be this varsity quarterback that they wanted him to be as a sophomore.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that that is very distressing. I mean, I see that so often. It's really, really sad. And then the parents sometimes do get a bit defensive when you try to talk to them and realize, well, why is it important for your son to be the varsity, you know, football player, you know, at this time?
It's all about the parents. It goes back to their own feelings of inadequacy. They may not have accomplished certain things in their life. And unfortunately, rather than allowing their children to find themselves and find their own goals and roles, that they want to project and put it on them. And so they put their own feelings and their own expectations on their children, and it creates a tremendous amount of stress in kids. Mm-hmm. And they feel like enough is never enough. They can never do enough to, you know, prove to their parents. I've seen this also with parents who insist on their kids being in accelerated academic programs, and the children don't want any part of it. And it's questionable whether the child actually should be in a program like that. And it creates a tremendous amount of stress.
Mm-hmm. How do you work with the children, provided the parents still want you to work with their child, in dealing with the, I call them, unrealistic expectations of the parents for them?
Well, hopefully the parents will allow me. In the case I mentioned earlier, they took child and off they went. He never came back. Mm-hmm. I felt so sad mm-hmm. about that happening. But there are cases where I believe that children become a metaphor for what's going on in the family. I'll see these kids and they can tell me all the problems. And these are the drop-off kids, that where the parents will drop them off for therapy. Now, there's a good aspect to that, because it gives me an opportunity to help them to learn how to cope, which is the question you're asking. Mm-hmm. And what I do with them is I basically help them to set their own boundaries, to set their own limits, to push back against their parents appropriately if they can, to tell their parents, this is what I want, this is not what I want, and to try to explore with their parents and say, you know, I think this is about what you want. It's really not about what I want. So part of it is really helping kids to feel empowered enough to tell their parents, look, this is about you. It's not about me. And to teach them how to do the work of coping more effectively by telling the parents what they want and what they need.
Mm-hmm. And then if the parents aren't able to hear them, you help the child understand that some people have their own way of seeing things, and no matter what, they're not going to see it differently. So how can I help you cope with that?
Well, you know, it's how do you know? It's like part of it is that the parents don't see it. What happens is the child will go about a certain task in a very not a very meaningful manner. I've seen kids where they just sabotage. They'll actually sabotage a performance because their parents wanted them in it. And there's not a whole lot you can do. I've had kids come in and say, you know, my parents thought I was the greatest violinist, but I never wanted to be a violin player, or I never wanted to do this. And sometimes kids will actually sabotage those performances, and there's not a whole lot. There's not a whole lot as a therapist I can do when, you know, kids don't want to be in a certain activity. They don't want anything to do with.
Yeah. Now, one of the questions we had here was having you describe cognitive therapy. So if you wouldn't mind taking a moment and describe that, that would be great.
Yeah, you know, cognitive therapy is just kind of a straightforward, pragmatic way of dealing with problems. I look at the presenting problems that people bring to me, and then I look at three things. I look at the spontaneous thoughts. What are the thoughts that go through people's minds when they think about a problem? Are they going down this trail of negative self-talk, or are they thinking clearly, and are they thinking positively about a particular problem? So I'm looking at that. Secondly, I'm looking at what are called cognitive distortions. These are the way in which people perceive the world. These are the lenses out of which they look at the world. Now, they may distort things, people, by saying, by personalizing things, by overgeneralizing, by excluding the positive from the negative, by either or thinking, you know, I'm either, you know, my neighbor's either the greatest flute player in the world, or they're nothing. Mm-hmm. So there's these different cognitive distortions that come into play. But I think the most important and powerful part of cognitive therapy has to do with what I call underlying interpretations or assumptions. And these are the principles and ways in which people act during childhood that kind of sometimes govern their lives, and they must be ferreted out. These things must be dealt with if they're negative and dealt with in adulthood. For example, I mentioned earlier I must avoid conflict at all costs. Every time I try to get close to people, someone stabs me in the back. Things like this, these are core assumptions that are generated from childhood in many times, and people need to understand them because they have power and they get activated in adulthood. Mm-hmm. So they need to be dealt with in adulthood.
And how does one process all that pain of their childhood and their past in cognitive therapy?
Well, I believe that part of it is to deal with the full emotional impact of what happened. People have all kinds of mechanisms for protecting themselves from the power of pain. And so what happens is that they may bury themselves in work, they may intellectualize, they may obsess, they may minimize their pain. They'll do all kinds of different things, people will, in order to keep from having to experience and feel the power of the pain of the past. And so what I try to do is get people in touch with the way things really were and the way things really are. Sometimes that means swallowing the bitter pill, understanding that there was no one, including their parents, who will be there to rescue them. And it's through this recognition and through the grieving and releasing of pain that people get freed up to new ways of thinking and behaving in the present.
And it can be pretty scary sometimes, I find, with some clients of changing that thought process because they're so used to behaving and reacting in a certain way. To change that's a bit scary, and I think that's where therapy is good because you get that support for changing and trying new ways of reacting and acting and thinking about things.
Well, people have been doing the same things over and over again for 20 years, 30 years.
Sure.
Whatever, it's very difficult to make those changes, and it is frightening. And I think it's important to be in a safe environment with people, and if therapy can be that, and to get support from people to say, hey, you can do this, you can change, you can make these changes, because what I see is people tend to go back to this slippery slope at times in terms of their thinking. They go back to this old way of looking at the world and old way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important to stay with them and say, no, this is what's happening. You're going on the spiral. You're pressing the play on the tape recorder, and you're going down this path, and we need to turn it around again.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what are, can you give a couple specific things that people could do if they're maybe listening right now and start thinking those negative thoughts and cognitive distortions, just a couple little ways that maybe they can reframe that for themselves to start thinking
Sure.
in a more positive way?
You know, one of the things that I tell people is to say, just wait a minute. Where's the evidence? So a lot of times it's like, okay, where's the evidence? Because people may be catastrophized. They may go, oh, my God, you know, the house is going to burn down. Something horrible is going to happen. And so I always tell them, you know, okay, where's the evidence that this worst-case scenario situation is going to happen? And generally, after thinking about it for a while, making a reasonable, plausible appraisal, they understand that nothing horrible is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
A person may be taking a midterm test in a class, and they open the test booklet, and they notice that the first three or four questions they can't comprehend. So they start down this path. They go, oh, my God, I can't pass this test. And what if I can't pass this test? I'm going to fail for the semester. If I fail for the semester, my parents are going to kill me,
mm-hmm.
and I could flunk out of this course. Okay, you can see this downward stream of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So another person opens the test booklet. They see that they can't answer the first three or four questions, and they go, okay, hold on a second. Just relax. Calm down. What I need to do is I need to go through the test booklet, and I need to answer the ones that I can. Then I'll go back once I'm centered, once I'm relaxed, and I'll look at the ones that I can't answer right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a more adaptive response to trying to deal with it, as opposed to all the negative thought processes that sometimes people go through.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just nodding my head to everything you're saying. That's basically what I do, too. I was wondering, too, we talked about the cognitive therapy, but add the behavioral part to it, the cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the behavioral part I think is important because I'll give people homework assignments. And the homework assignments are generally behavioral in orientation. For example, I have a person come in to see me and they're very socially anxious. I had one gentleman recently. And one of the things that he had a problem with was crowded places. He didn't like to be in any crowded places. And in this case, it happened to be a shopping mall. Okay, so I encouraged him as his homework assignment that he was to go to a shopping mall for 15 minutes, anyone that he could think of, on an off time when there's hardly anybody there. All I wanted to do is to walk through, and then I wanted him to walk out, go back in his car and leave. And then I wanted him to write about what that experience was like. I wanted him to look around at the people. I wanted to see what was going on, and then I wanted to come back.
Mm-hmm.
First week, he wouldn't do it. After the second time he came in, he did it, and he went. And he found that it wasn't so horrible. And now I'm upping it, and I'm having him go another time to a mall that's more crowded,
mm-hmm.
and seeing if he can handle that exposure. So part of it is just having people do and act on things that they may be terrified to do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's my definition of courage.
And it does take a lot of courage on that, and also just to admit that you do have a fear or you are afraid of, you know, being out, going to a movie. You don't want to go to the movie. You avoid it because the real fear is you don't want to be around all those people or what have you because of some underlying fear you think of what might or might not happen. But then again, it's that stopping and looking at the evidence. Is it true that, you know, the fireplace will or the movie theater will burn down or whatever it is? Is there any evidence to that, or can you just go sit and enjoy being in that group of people?
Well, one of the things I did with this gentleman, even before he went, was cognitive rehearsal,
mm-hmm.
which meant that I had him do some meditation, just guided relaxation, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the guided relaxation, I had him to rehearse being in that situation of going to the mall, getting in the car, every little step, getting him to the place, getting out, going into the mall, looking around. So I had him rehearse it under a very controlled and safe environment at home. Mm-hmm. And then going ahead and doing it, because we know that the more safe people feel, the more they're capable of doing these experiences, because what trips them up is their fear that they have to avoid and get out of an uncomfortable situation.
Exactly. Well, and I could talk about this forever with you. I love cognitive behavioral therapy. It is one of the most widely accepted interventions that people could use. And you see it, you actually see the changes, and the clients see the changes, and that's very empowering for them to see. But I'm afraid at this time, although I've been brief with you, I really appreciate you being with us for the entire show with Alan Cardoza. So on behalf of him and myself, thank you, James Crobell, for being with us today. He is an educator, writer, licensed professional counselor, nationally certified cognitive behavioral therapist in Scottsdale, Arizona. Check out his latest book, Troubled Childhood, Triumphant Life, Healing from the Battle Scars of Youth. It's about the impact of troubled childhoods on adult functioning. You can get it at Amazon.com or go to his website at www.scottsdaletherapy.net. And I just want to say again, James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And until next time, have a wonderful day and a great week, and take good care of yourself and your family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.